8% of Indian soldiers served. In Gallipoli, 9,400 men. In Aden and the Persian Gulf, 50,000 men. In Egypt, 116,000 men. And overwhelmingly in Mesopotamia, nearly 590,000 men. Following the example of British India, where Muslim rulers had spoken out so eloquently against the Sultan's declaration of jihad, the French mobilized loyal Muslim notables to denounce the Ottoman entry into the war on religious grounds. Starting at the top, the French secured endorsements from the Bey of Tunis and the Sultan of Morocco, who exhorted their soldiers to fight valiantly for the French and called on their people to submit to and obey the colonial authorities. The muftis of the Maliki and Hanafi schools of Islamic law in Algeria made explicit reference to the position of Muslims in India, the Caucasus, and Egypt in opposing the Sultan's call for jihad. Other religious leaders, heads of religious fraternities, judges, and other notables declared their loyalty to the Allied cause, condemned the Germans and their young Turk protégés, and dismissed the Sultan's claim to caliphal authority and his right to declare jihad on behalf of the Muslim community. The colonial authorities published dozens of such declarations in Arabic, with translations judiciously edited by French scholars. The propaganda war both for and against the Ottoman jihad was being fought by European Orientalists, British, French, and German. The Germans had some success in their efforts to win Muslim enemy combatants over to jihad against Britain and France. They recruited Islamic activists like Sheikh Saleh al-Sharif to the cause. Born in Tunis to Algerian exiles from French rule, Saleh al-Sharif was an Islamic scholar and descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. Saleh al-Sharif left his native land in 1900 in protest against French rule. The Tunisian activist came to the attention of the Young Turk leadership in 1911 during the Libyan War, in which he served under Enver. It was Saleh al-Sharif who reportedly declared jihad against Italy, giving the war its overtly religious overtones. Enver, already impressed by the power of Islam to mobilize resistance to European encroachment, recruited al-Sharif to his intelligence organization, the Teşkilat-i Mahsusa. In 1914, Saleh al-Sharif moved to Berlin, where he joined a new propaganda unit under the German Foreign Ministry, the Nachrichtenstelle für den Orient, Intelligence Office for the East. The Tunisian activist visited the Western Front to appeal directly to Muslim soldiers fighting for Britain and France across the trenches. He drafted a number of pamphlets, published in both Arabic and Berber, which were dropped over enemy lines in areas held by North African soldiers, along with news of the Sultan's declaration of jihad. A number of North African soldiers deserted from French lines in response to this overtly Islamic appeal. As the Germans began to take Muslim prisoners on the Western Front, some 800 by the end of 1914, they created a special facility called Halbmondlager, Crescent Moon Camp, at Wünsdorf-Sossen, near Berlin. The camp's German commanders spoke Arabic with the prisoners. Camp food was fully compliant with Islamic dietary requirements. The camp even had an ornate mosque, paid for by Wilhelm II himself, to provide for the spiritual needs of Muslim POWs, and to prove the Kaiser's good intentions towards the Muslim world. Ahmed bin Hussein, an elderly farmer from Marrakesh, was one of 8 Moroccan soldiers who surrendered to German forces in the battlefields of Belgium. From the moment the men declared themselves to be Muslims, he claimed, the German captors showed us due respect. Everybody was patting our shoulders and giving us food and beverages. He was sent to a special camp for Muslim POWs, no doubt the Halbmondlager. They even made a favor for us and gave us a kitchen. Pork was not to be given to us. They gave us good meat, pilaf, chickpeas, etc. They gave 3 blankets, underwear, and a new pair of shoes to each of us. They took us to the baths once in every 3 days and cut our hair. The conditions in camp were a great improvement over what he had experienced in the French army and at the front. A parade of Muslim activists passed through the Sossen camp to promote jihad propaganda among a, literally, captive audience. The Tunisian activist Saleh al-Sharif was a frequent visitor and edited an Arabic-language newspaper for inmates called, appropriately enough, Al-Jihad. A number of North African activists and notables visited the camp to meet the inmates and win them to the Central Powers' cause. These guest speakers lectured inmates on why fighting with the Allies was an act against religion, and why joining the Ottoman Jihad against the enemies of Islam, that is, Britain and France, was a religious duty. Hundreds of POWs volunteered for the Ottoman army, among them the Moroccan farmer Ahmed bin Hussein. After he had spent 6 months in the special POW camp for Muslim soldiers, a German officer arrived, accompanied by an Ottoman officer named Hikmet Efendi. "Whoever wants to go to Istanbul," they declared, "raise your hand." 12 Moroccan and Algerian soldiers volunteered on the spot. "Others were afraid," Ahmed bin Hussein added. "They were given civilian clothes and passports and sent on to Istanbul to join the Ottoman war effort." It is impossible to say how many Muslim prisoners volunteered for Ottoman service out of conviction and how many to get out of a POW camp. Whatever their motives, Indian and North African soldiers left Germany for Istanbul in a steady stream to join the Sultan's war. Mobilized for a second time, as Muslim rather than colonial soldiers, they would re-enter the rapidly expanding world war on its Middle Eastern fronts. By the time the Ottomans declared war, the men who would fight in the Middle East had been mobilized and were making their way to fronts at every point along the Ottoman Empire's exposed frontiers. North Africans had already fought and died in the thousands on the Western Front, and a fraction of their ranks held in German POW camps would change sides and join the Ottomans. Anzac cavalry and infantry were sailing across the Indian Ocean towards Egypt. Some soldiers from India were making their way up the Persian Gulf towards Mesopotamia, while others were sailing past Ottoman Yemen en route to Egypt. Ottoman soldiers were concentrating in eastern Anatolia and Syria in advance of drives against Russian positions in the Caucasus and British lines in Egypt. Europe's war had come to the Middle East. 4. Opening salvos. Basra, Aden, Egypt, and the Eastern Mediterranean. The Ottoman Empire was born of war, its frontiers drawn through centuries of conquest and conflict. However, only in November 1914, as the Ottomans entered the First Global War, did they face the threat of war on all their frontiers at once. With over 7,500 miles of borders and coastlines spanning the Black Sea, the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea, and the Mediterranean, the Ottomans presented their enemies with many points vulnerable to attack. No sooner had the Ottomans entered the war than they came under Allied assault at disparate points in their far-flung empire. The naval vessels of the Entente powers fired the first salvos even before war had been formally declared. British warships in the Red Sea bombarded an isolated 100-man fort at the head of the Gulf of Aqaba on 1 November 1914. 2 days later, British and French ships stationed off the Dardanelles subjected the outer defences of the straits to a blistering bombardment. In just 20 minutes of shelling, the Allied ships hit an ammunition storage depot, destroying the Sedr el-Bahr fort and dismounting its guns. The Ottomans were unable to respond to these attacks, immediately demonstrating both the vulnerability of their coastline and the Entente's naval supremacy. The Entente powers believed Turkey was the weak link in the Central Alliance and the easiest belligerent to knock out of the war. As the conflict on the Western and Russo-German fronts settled into stalemate, only the Ottoman front held the prospect of a quick Allied victory. The Entente powers were confident the Turks would buckle rapidly under the combined onslaught of Britain, France, and Russia. In the opening days of Turkey's war, both Russia and Britain sent troops to secure a foothold inside the lightly defended peripheries of the Ottoman Empire. Russia was the first to attack the Ottomans with ground forces. Immediately after the Goeben and Breslau bombarded their Black Sea ports and shipping on 29 October, the Russians sent a detachment across the Caucasus frontier into eastern Anatolia. Russian intelligence suggested that, With only 70,000 to 80,000 soldiers in the Erzurum region, the Ottomans did not have the forces to threaten Russian positions in the Caucasus. Consequently, the Russians limited their ambitions to securing a buffer zone along the frontier, allowing their commanders to commit more troops to the battle against Germany and Austria. Russian General Georgi Bergmann led his soldiers into Ottoman territory at dawn on 2 November 1914. Over the next 3 days, the Russians advanced without encountering any significant resistance. By 5 November, the Russians had secured a salient running parallel with their own frontier some 15 miles deep. Their mission fulfilled, Bergmann ordered his troops to fortify their positions along the heights overlooking the Pasin Valley, some 50 miles from the fortified town of Erzurum. Perhaps the ease with which the Russians had occupied Turkish territory had gone to the Russian commander's head, for without consulting headquarters, he decided to exceed his orders and continue his conquest deeper into Erzurum province. He ordered his soldiers to move on to the strategic village of Köprükhöy, bridging the Aras River, halfway between the Russian frontier and Erzurum. Bergmann did not know that the Turkish High Command had been following the Russian advance with growing concern. On 4 November, Enver Pasha, the Ottoman Minister of War, had sent a telegram to Hasan İzzet Pasha, the Turkish commander in Erzurum, proposing an Ottoman counterattack against the invading Russians. Though concerned that his Third Army was under strength, Hasan İzzet Pasha knew better than to question the judgment of his superiors and dispatched a large force to engage the Russians. They met on the banks of the Aras River on the evening of 6 November in what would prove the first Ottoman battle of the Great War. Corporal Ali Riza Eti was a medic with one of the units sent to fight the Russians at Köprükhöy. Eti was an educated man from a village near the eastern Turkish town of Erzincan. When called up for military service, he was 27 years old and married, with one son. Eti had much to live for, but was willing to give his life fighting the Russians. His father, a veteran of the 1877 to 1878 Russo-Turkish War, had been deeply scarred by the Ottoman defeat. In 1914, Eti went to war to settle old scores. Eti's unit was sent into combat at dawn on 7 November. The soldiers made slow progress over roads turned to mud by the cold autumnal rains. As they approached the front at Köprükhöy, the artillery grew more intense and gunfire rained down on the frightened soldiers. In his diary, Eti tried to capture the sound of the bullets. Juv, juv, juv. As it was my first day of fighting, I was very afraid of dying. With each juv, I broke out in a sweat from my teeth to my toenails. As the Ottoman soldiers advanced into position, they could no longer stand in the intensive firing. The fighting went on well into the night. At 3 a.m., Eti and his comrades pitched their half-patched tent and tried to get some sleep in the terrible cold. "We shivered until morning," he wrote. Fighting resumed early the next day. Russian artillery subjected the Turkish lines to intense shrapnel fire, the spray of sharp metal fragments cutting down men and work animals. While writing this line, a shrapnel shell, jeep, burst on the hill above me. The dead are scattered around like a weeping willow. Because the fighting was too intense for the medics to get to the wounded, Eti grabbed a Mauser rifle and went to join the fighting at the front line. "Riza Effendi, get down flat and bring ammunition with you," his captain shouted. Armed with two boxes of cartridges and his medical supplies, Eti took aim and fired at the Russian soldiers on the hills opposite. With characteristic precision, he claimed to have fired 83 rounds of ammunition and killed a Russian lieutenant and three other soldiers, adding regretfully, "The other shots were wasted." The Turkish soldiers held their positions against a Russian attempt to outflank them. Their captain, to encourage his men, went around distributing fresh ammunition. "Their bullets don't touch us," he shouted in a display of ill-timed bravura. At that moment he was shot in the neck, fell to his knees, and died before his downcast soldiers. "Come, comrades, we aren't making war for this captain's sake, but for God's sake," another officer shouted, opening fire on the Russians. Snapped out of their despondency, the Turkish soldiers fought for their lives as their artillery took the measure of the Russian lines. A series of well-aimed artillery shells killed and wounded scores of Russian soldiers and forced the survivors into retreat. At 10 o'clock, Etty recorded, the enemy was retreating from all fronts. Everyone is overjoyed. As the fighting died down, Etty resumed his work as a medic, recovering the wounded from the battlefield and dispatching them to the rear. The medics recognized many of their friends among the dead and wounded, and were appalled by this first experience of the casualties of war. After they had finished their work among the Turkish lines, Etty ventured to the former Russian positions to take a closer look at the man he had killed. The Russian lieutenant lay where he had fallen. Etty expressed no sympathy for the guy he had shot. He consistently referred to him by the derogatory Turkish word for man, herif, and took his revolver, satchel, binoculars, and sword. Inside the satchel he found a bundle of letters, a lavender-scented handkerchief, a glove, a flask, and some Russian money. Quite a godsend, Etty mused. He gave the binoculars to his regimental commander, the sword to the doctor, and the satchel to the commander's adjutant. Reflecting on his squadron's losses on their first day of combat, one captain and 5 men martyred and 36 wounded, Etty concluded, "We lost the dreams of battle that we had carried inside us this morning." Through determined resistance, the Turkish infantry succeeded in holding its lines. The Russians made a last assault on 11 November and lost 40% of their forces in the attempt. With their ammunition running low and facing determined Ottoman attacks on both flanks, the Russians were forced into retreat under fire. Bergmann's troops fell back to the line they had originally secured on 5 November, some 15 miles into Ottoman territory. Both sides paid a heavy price for Bergmann's adventure. According to Turkish figures, the Ottomans suffered over 8,000 casualties in the November offensive, 1,983 dead and 6,170 wounded, and lost an additional 3,070 soldiers taken prisoner and nearly 2,800 deserters. The Russians lost 1,000 dead in battle, 4,000 wounded, and another 1,000 who died of exposure. Blooded, the two sides reinforced their positions before the first snowfalls rendered the highlands of the Caucasus all but impassable, assuming that neither side would resume the fight before the spring. Enver Pasha, encouraged by this comparatively satisfactory beginning, would soon come to the Caucasus himself to renew the fight with Russia. For the moment, however, the Ottoman High Command was preoccupied with a British invasion in Mesopotamia. The city of Basra is strategically situated on the Shatal Arab, a river running between the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates and the head of the Persian Gulf. It was the last port accessible to ocean-going steamers on the Shat, and served as the commercial gateway between Mesopotamia and the Persian Gulf. A few miles south of Basra, the Shat also marked the boundary between the Persian and Ottoman empires, as it does between Iran and Iraq today, the border lying midway between the river banks. The Persian reaches of the Shat were of particular interest to the British, for the Anglo-Persian Oil Company had struck oil in commercial quantities there in May 1908. In May 1901, the Devon-born millionaire William Knox Darcy had secured a 60-year concession to explore for oil in Persia. His company enjoyed the financial support of a British syndicate and the political backing of the Royal Navy, which was determined to secure a reliable source of fuel for its fleet as it shifted from coal to oil. After striking oil near the southern Persian city of Ahwaz, Anglo-Persian sought a location for a refinery with access to the sea to export its petroleum, settling on the island of Abadan in the Shatt el-Arab, 140 miles to the south of the oil field. Abadan provided an ideal site to build a refinery, with direct access to the sea lanes, and the owner of the island, Sheikh Khazal of the nearby town of Mahamara, now the Iranian city of Khorram Shah, was a British protege. With 20,000 horsemen at his command, the Arabic-speaking Khazal was a powerful local leader. In 1902, Britain had pledged to protect Sheikh Ghazal's mini-state in return for his adherence to the British treaty system, binding most of the Arab rulers in the Persian Gulf. Now that oil had been discovered, Britain placed an even higher premium on its friendship with the Sheikh. The British resident in the Gulf, Sir Percy Cox, was dispatched to Mahamara to negotiate a lease with Ghazal for the necessary land on Abadan Island for a refinery, storage tanks, and dock. In July 1909, they concluded a 10-year agreement for £6,500 cash in hand and a loan of £10,000. The pipeline was laid, the refinery built, and oil began to flow from Abadan in 1912. Between oil, trade, and a century-old position of supremacy in the Persian Gulf, it was natural that Britain would choose Mesopotamia as its prize in any post-war partition of the Ottoman Empire. Even before opening negotiations with Russia and France, the British had already sent an expeditionary force to secure its claim to Basra. British plans to invade Basra were made in strict secrecy by London and India in September and October 1914. Given the reverence Indian Muslims showed the Ottoman Sultan as the Caliph of Islam, the British feared that a premature attack on the Sultan's domains might provoke religious riots. The challenge was to pre-position British troops near Basra ahead of an Ottoman declaration of war, without their deployment being seen as a hostile act against the still-neutral Ottoman Empire. This meant keeping the deployment secret, even from the commander and troops who would take part in the campaign. When Brigadier General Walter de la Main boarded ship in Bombay on 16 October to sail as part of the Indian Expeditionary Force, IEF, to the Western Front, he received his orders under seal, with strict instructions to wait 72 hours before reading and acting on them. After 3 days at sea, de la Main opened his orders and learned that he was to command a brigade of the 6th Pune Division of the Indian Army, designated IEFD, for service in the Persian Gulf. The 5,000 soldiers and their mounts, 1,400 horses and pack mules, had been grouped in four shallow draft transports that could navigate some of the shallower waters of the Gulf. De la Main was to proceed immediately to Bahrain to await further instructions. De la Main reached Bahrain with his brigade on 23 October. He was met by Sir Percy Cox, the former resident in the Gulf, who had been assigned as chief political officer to IEFD. Only after he reached Bahrain did de la Main learn that he was to proceed to the Shatt el-Arab to secure the Anglo-Persian oil refinery and storage tanks at Abadan and protect the pipeline from Turkish attack. De la Main was to enlist the support of Britain's Arab allies at the head of the Gulf, Sheikh Ghazal, Kuwaiti ruler Sheikh Mubarak al-Sabah, and Ibn Saud in eastern Arabia. So long as they remained neutral, de la Main's orders decreed, he was to avoid any hostile action against the Turks without orders from the government of India. Once the Ottomans had declared war, however, de la Main was free to take such military and political action as would strengthen his position, and, if possible, to occupy Basra. After 6 days at anchor, de la Main was ordered to proceed to the mouth of the Shatt on 29 October, the same day the Ottoman fleet initiated hostilities against Russia in the Black Sea. Word of the campaign's departure from Bahrain reached Basra quickly, setting off a flurry of military and political preparations. From the moment the British troop transports arrived in Bahrain, rumours had begun to circulate in Basra of an imminent attack. Now that Europe's distant war was on their doorstep, the townspeople were unsure of what they wanted. The outgoing British consul, Reader Bullard, reported strong anti-Russian and anti-British feeling in Basra at the end of October. However, the town lived on trade, and its economy would be gravely undermined if it were isolated from the rest of the Persian Gulf by Ottoman hostilities with Britain. Loyalties towards the Ottomans were lukewarm at best. Many of the town's notables openly opposed Young Turk policies they deemed inimical to Arab interests. A group of like-minded leaders in Basra had formed the Reform Society in 1913, one of the most influential Arabist societies in Iraq. Like Al-Fatat and the Decentralization Party, The Basra Reform Society advocated Arab cultural rights and greater autonomy in a decentralized Ottoman Empire. The leader of the movement was Sayyid Tolib el-Nakib. The most prominent personality in pre-war Basra, Sayyid Tolib was first elected to the Ottoman Parliament in 1908. After initial cooperation with the Committee of Union and Progress, CUP, he grew increasingly outspoken in favour of Arab cultural and political rights. In the course of his parliamentary career, he made dangerous enemies among the Turkish nationalists in the CUP. The Unionists, believing Sayyid Tolib had separatist aspirations for Basra, openly threatened the local leader. Although Reform Society candidates swept the 1914 Ottoman parliamentary elections in the province of Basra, Sayyid Tolib did not dare travel to Istanbul to take up his seat for fear the Unionists might assassinate him. Süleyman Faidi, another native of Basra elected to the Ottoman Parliament in 1914 on the Reform Society list, remembered how the British tried to recruit Sayyid Tolib to collaborate in their occupation of Basra. Drawing on the good offices of their ally, Sheikh Khazal, British officials invited Sayyid Tolib to a secret meeting in Muhammara in the crucial days before IEFD reached the Shat. In return for his cooperation, they offered to name Sayyid Tolib governor-general over the province of Basra under British protection, with tax-free privileges and British development assistance. Sayyid Tolib declined, arguing that he was unwilling to trade one master for another, the British for the Ottomans. Rather than follow his neighbours into the British trucial system, Sayyid Tolib decided to throw in his lot with the Ottomans instead. His decision was complicated by the fact that the Unionists had issued a warrant for his arrest on charges of treason. In a desperate bid to prove his loyalty and reverse his fortunes, Sayyid Tolib sent a telegram to Enver Pasha, pledging to secure the support of Saudi ruler Ibn Saud for the defence of Basra from British invasion. The Unionists had nothing to lose from this initiative, and suggested that, if he were successful, Sayyid Tolib might be rewarded with the governorship of Basra for his efforts. The British, already concerned about Arab loyalties, had been working to preempt any Ottoman initiative to recruit Gulf sheikhs to their cause, or to rally Arab tribes to a global jihad against the Entente. On 31 October, the political resident in the Gulf, S.G. Knox, issued a proclamation to the rulers and sheikhs in the Persian Gulf and their subjects, announcing the Ottoman entry into the war. "Your relations with Great Britain are of long standing," Knox reminded Britain's Arab allies, "and I take this opportunity of assuring you that, in this struggle, we shall do our utmost to preserve for you your liberty and religion." To reinforce this point, on 3 November the British concluded a formal agreement recognizing Kuwait's independence from the Ottoman Empire under British protection. In return, the ruler of Kuwait, Sheikh Mubarak, pledged to work with Sheikh Khazal, Ibn Saud, and other reliable sheikhs to help liberate Basra from Turkish possession. Sir Percy Cox, IEFD's chief political officer, was in constant contact with Britain's Arab allies, coordinating actions to ensure local support for the invasion of southern Mesopotamia. On 5 November, Cox dispatched a proclamation to the Arab rulers at the head of the Gulf to advise them of the approach of British forces, which he claimed had been sent to the Shat to protect Britain's commerce and friends and expel the hostile Turkish troops. The British had the Gulf stitched up well before Sayyid Tolib al-Nakib launched his initiative to win Ibn Saud to the Ottoman cause. As he rode from Basra to Muhammara, Kuwait, and the Nejd, Sayyid Tolib al-Nakib found every local leader in the Gulf opposed to his Ottoman initiative. Sheikh Khazal tried to persuade his friend Tolib to reconsider Britain's terms. The ruler of Kuwait threatened to place Sayyid Tolib and his colleagues under house arrest on Britain's instructions. "If you try to prevent me from leaving Kuwait," the irate al-Nakib threatened Sheikh Mubarak, "I will fire two shots with my revolver, the first one at you and the second one at myself." Though Sayyid Talib and a small group of his friends did manage to slip out of Kuwait, it took 9 days of intensive riding to reach Ibn Saud at El Bureida in the Qasim region of north-central Arabia. The Saudi ruler received his guests with sympathy and hospitality. Ibn Saud did not hide the fact that he was in correspondence with the British, whom he claimed were urging him to preserve his neutrality. Britain would only formalize treaty relations with him in 1915. Ibn Saud was clearly torn. Given the importance of religion to his own movement, he could not be seen to support the non-Muslim British at the expense of his Arab Muslim brothers in Basra. Yet Ibn Saud was wary of antagonizing the British, given their powerful presence in the Gulf. And so he procrastinated, in the hope that the matter would resolve itself before he was forced to take sides. Ibn Saud waited 9 days before mobilizing a group of 500 horsemen to ride towards the head of the Gulf. The Saudi leader, who could ride night and day when the cause was urgent, traveled only 4 hours a day with Sayyid Talib's delegation. On reaching its first post station in late November, the Saudi force learned that Basra had already fallen to the British. The news hit the men of Basra like a bolt of lightning, Suleiman Faidi recorded. The shock was particularly violent for Sayyid Talib, who knew the depths of English hatred for him. However, the resolution of the crisis must have been a relief to Ibn Saud. He expressed his sympathies to the men of Basra and returned to pursue his own priorities in Central Arabia. The fall of Basra left Sayyid Talib an exile. He had failed the Ottomans and alienated the British. He rode back to Kuwait and surrendered to the British. He was sent to India for the duration of the war, which all sides imagined would be quite brief. Yet the British occupation of Basra initiated a far longer campaign in Mesopotamia than Sayyid Talib had ever anticipated. On 5 November, Great Britain declared war on the Ottoman Empire. At dawn the next day, British units of the Indian Expeditionary Force entered Turkish territorial waters in the Shatt al-Arab. The sloop HMS Odin, a hybrid warship that combined steam engines with sailing masts, took up position inside the mouth of the Shatt and opened fire on the Turkish gun emplacements on the Fao Peninsula. Within an hour, the fort's commander had been killed, and the Ottoman soldiers, some 400 men in all, abandoned the position. Delamain landed 500 men to destroy the guns and establish a secure telegraph line from Fao to India by underwater cable. The action was not without its difficulties. Strong tidal streams disrupted the landing craft, and the muddy banks of the Shatt estuary compounded the difficulty of getting men, horses, and cannon ashore in the absence of any docks or jetties. However, the quick and decisive action, achieved without any British casualties, augured well for the British campaign. Delamain left a company of soldiers to protect the telegraph station at Fao, and moved up the Shatt with the rest of his brigade to secure the oil facilities at Abadan. He landed his troops at Saniya on the Turkish banks of the river upstream from the refinery. Without adequate lighters, it took 2 days to ferry men, their mounts and materiel from the transport ships to the shore. Transport issues would plague the Mesopotamia campaign. In the absence of proper roads, everything had to be moved by river. Yet the river was shallow and full of obstructions placed by the Ottomans, and its muddy banks complicated movements on and off ship. However, from their encampment at Saniya, the soldiers of IEFD were well positioned to protect Abadan from Ottoman attack. Delamain decided to wait until reinforcements arrived before attempting to move upriver towards Basra. The Ottomans mounted an attack on Anglo-Indian positions on 11 November, inflicting the first casualties on IEFD before retreating under fire. The Indian and British troops had to defend themselves in an alien environment that discouraged bold movements. Sudden, drenching rainstorms turned the banks of the Shatt into quagmires of mud, while strong winds whipped up sandstorms that cut all visibility and signal communications. Mirages proved one of the most perplexing natural phenomena for the troops, making visual identification on the battlefield almost impossible. As Edmund Candler, a journalist embedded with IEFD as an official eyewitness, recalled, "Mirages made it difficult to tell if the enemy were on horse or on foot, or to make any estimate of their numbers. There is not a cavalry regiment with the force which has not at some time or other mistaken sheep for infantry. Caution seemed to dictate waiting until the expeditionary force was strengthened before advancing up the Scheldt. Reinforcements arrived on 14 November. Lieutenant General Sir Arthur Barrett reached the Scheldt with the remainder of the 6th Indian Division to take command of IEFD. With enough troops both to protect Abadan and march on Basra, Barrett was confident he could resume hostilities without undue risk. He had valuable support from the Royal Navy, which had dispatched a number of shallow-draft warships to the Scheldt. The naval vessels were capable of both transporting the forces and shelling Ottoman positions with their heavy guns. With the Ottomans reeling from the sudden appearance of the invasion force, Barrett wanted to strike before the defenders had the chance to regroup and confront the invaders. The British attacked Ottoman lines the day after Barrett arrived and drove the defenders from their positions, leaving over 160 dead and wounded men on the field. 2 days later, on 17 November, they engaged the Ottomans at Sahil, in heavy rains, followed by sandstorms. Both sides suffered losses, nearly 500 British and Indian dead and wounded, and an estimated 1,500 to 2,000 Ottoman casualties, before the Anglo-Indian army took the Ottoman lines and forced the defenders to retreat a second time. In his dispatches, Barrett claimed the operations had proved the superiority of our troops over the Turks and the demoralization of the Turks after their severe losses. After a string of swift defeats, the Ottomans decided their position in Basra was untenable and abandoned the city on 21 November. As soon as the government authorities had left, rioters swept the city to destroy government offices and plunder businesses. John Van Ess, acting American consul in Basra, sent a letter by river courier appealing to the British commander to send a force sufficient to guard against pillage. Basra had succumbed to total lawlessness. All yesterday the Arabs have been robbing the places vacated by the government, and there has been continual firing. The Royal Navy sloops Espiègle and Odin were dispatched immediately to Basra to secure the waterfront until the troops could arrive overland the following day. On 23 November, Barrett made a ceremonial entry into Basra, where the British flag was raised over the city centre to mark the town's passage from Ottoman to British control. Sir Percy Cox drafted a rousing proclamation that he read to the gathered townspeople in his English-accented Arabic. "The British government has now occupied Basra, but though a state of war with the Ottoman government still prevails, yet we have no enmity or ill will against the populace, to whom we hope to prove good friends and protectors. No remnant of Turkish administration now remains in this region. In place thereof, the British flag has been established, under which you will enjoy the benefits of liberty and justice, both in regard to your religious and your secular affairs." Cox's proclamation confused the British and the Basrans alike. The British were unsure how much liberty they wanted to concede to the people of Basra, and the people of Basra had no idea just how long the British would remain. For many, after centuries of Ottoman rule, it was hard to imagine that the Turks would not eventually return. So long as there remained any chance of an Ottoman restoration, the local townspeople would keep their distance from the British for fear of later reprisals. Once in Basra, the British had effectively achieved their objectives in Mesopotamia. They had driven the Ottomans from the head of the Persian Gulf and protected the strategic oil facilities in Abadan. Sir Percy Cox made a strong case for pursuing the retreating Ottoman forces to seize Baghdad, but was overruled by military planners and the government of India. Instead, the British authorized a limited advance to the town of Kurna, at the juncture of the Tigris and Euphrates, which would place the whole of the Scheldt el-Arab under British control. The campaign for Kurna began on 3 December. Royal Navy vessels carried the soldiers to a safe landing spot 4 miles south of the town. As the invaders marched up the left bank of the Scheldt, they encountered growing opposition from Ottoman defenders, who managed to halt the Anglo-Indian force before withdrawing across the Tigris. Clearly, the Ottomans hoped to buy time to regroup by putting the river between themselves and IEF forces. But when the invaders managed to secure a pontoon bridge across the Tigris, the Ottomans knew their position was untenable. Just before midnight on 6 December, a small river steamer carrying three Turkish commanders made its way towards the British ships with all lights blazing and sirens blaring to negotiate their surrender. The handover took place on 9 December, when the governor of the province of Basra, Subi Bey, delivered the town of Kurna to the commander of the Indian Expeditionary Force and surrendered, along with 45 officers and 989 soldiers, becoming a prisoner of war. British operations in the Sharq al-Arab had been deceptively easy. Quick victories were secured with remarkably light British casualties. Fewer than 100 British and Indian soldiers were killed, and some 675 wounded in the fighting between Fao and Kurna. The Ottomans, on the other hand, suffered some 3,000 dead and wounded, four times the number of British casualties. Such relatively easy gains gave the British a distorted sense of their own abilities and led them to underestimate their Ottoman foe. Having secured their position in Basra, the British settled down to administer the region. As occupiers, the British were bound by the laws of war to preserve the institutions of the Ottoman state. The unwillingness of the local inhabitants to cooperate with the new authorities, however, compromised their work. The British continued to attribute this recalcitrance to local fear of a possible return by the Ottomans. Yet it might just as well have reflected a native dislike for the foreign occupiers, an antipathy reinforced by British security measures in Mesopotamia. Private William Byrd, a soldier in one of the Dorset battalions of IEFD, described a typical village search near Basra in January 1915. Anglo-Indian soldiers would approach a village at dawn, break down all doors not answered on the first knock, make prisoners of all the male occupants, then search everything and everywhere for arms. The British practiced rough justice among villagers suspected of resisting their occupation. "Those who attempt to run away are caught by our ring of men outside the village," Byrd noted. "They are treated as combatants and meet their end on the scaffold. And, of course, those who shoot at us are either shot or captured and hung in the market square." Such measures were unlikely to win the affections of the native inhabitants of Basra province. Nor did the British hold out a vision of greater political freedoms to win over the people of Basra. When the Viceroy of India, Lord Hardinge, visited Basra and Kurna in February 1915, he toned down Cox's sweeping promise of liberty and justice, offering instead a more benign administration and restored prosperity. Rather than greater autonomy or self-rule, the British occupation seemed to promise a British administration. Sayyid Toleb al-Nakib had not been mistaken. The people of Basra had exchanged masters, British for Ottoman. After seeing off Delamain's brigade for service in the Persian Gulf, the remainder of the Indian Expeditionary Force had continued on its course to Egypt. The fleet called in to the Arabian port of Aden before entering the Red Sea. The port was the centre of a tiny colony, 80 square miles, conquered by the British and annexed to their Indian Empire in 1839. The Royal Navy originally used Aden as a base for operations against piracy. With the opening of the Suez Canal in 1869, Aden proved the ideal location for a coaling station for steamships running between Britain and India. Like Hong Kong, Aden developed into one of the essential stepping stones in Britain's maritime empire and an important trade emporium in its own right. In the second half of the 19th century, the British had concluded a series of treaties with the tribes in the territories surrounding Aden, creating a special zone of influence known as the Aden Protectorate. The Protectorate comprised 9 distinct mini-states with their own autonomous rulers, British protégés, whose combined territory added up to 9,000 square miles of coastal territory on the southernmost tip of Arabia. The Aden Protectorate abutted the Ottoman province of Yemen. Between 1902 and 1905, an Anglo-Turkish Boundary Commission demarcated the frontier between the two territories. With the Ottoman entry into the war in 1914, this was suddenly transformed into a hostile border, and the second point of engagement between Britain and the Ottoman Empire. The border between Ottoman Yemen and the Aden Protectorate met at the Bab el-Mendab Straits. the gateway to the Red Sea. The southernmost point of Ottoman territory was Sheikh Said, where the Turks maintained a series of hilltop forts with guns dominating the sea lanes. The British held Perim Island, a 5-square-mile rock facing Sheikh Said in the Bab el-Mendab Straits, some 100 miles west of Aden. In early November, British intelligence reported the Turks were massing troops in Sheikh Said. Analysts speculated the Ottoman forces intended to open hostilities against British positions in the Aden Protectorate, or even to occupy Perim Island. Given the strategic importance of the Red Sea waterways to the British Empire at war, all troopships from New Zealand, Australia, and India had to pass through the Bab el-Mendab to reach the Suez Canal. British war planners in India decided to disperse Ottoman troops and disable their guns at Sheikh Said. Fresh troops were dispatched from India to Aden on 2 November to secure Britain's island in the Straits. On the morning of 10 November, British ships off Perim opened fire on Ottoman positions on the hilltops of Sheikh Said. Lieutenant H.V. Gell, a signaller in the 69th Punjabis, was impatient for the bombardment to end, so that he and the rest of the landing party could go ashore for their first action. The men boarded landing ships and were towed to shore by a slow-moving tugboat, while Turkish gunners fired with increasing precision from the heights overlooking the beach. As they rowed the final stretch to shore, a shell struck within yards of Gell's boat, killing a young Indian reservist. The other men made it to land safely, where they regrouped and waited for orders to begin their attack on Ottoman positions. Taking shelter from intensive fire, the Anglo-Indian landing party waited over 4 hours before beginning their ascent towards Turkish positions. "There was very little firing then," Gell recalled, "only a few stray bullets now and then." By the time the Anglo-Indian forces reached the first ridge, they found the Ottomans had abandoned their positions. No doubt the bombardment from British ships, combined with the advance of landing parties, had convinced the defenders that their position was untenable. Given the quantities of clothes, arms, and ammunition left behind, the Ottomans clearly retreated in panic. "The only pity was they got away," Gell noted in his diary. "Their numbers were estimated at about 500. While Gell had no knowledge of Ottoman casualties, he did not see any Turkish dead, he reported 5 Indian and British soldiers killed and 11 wounded in the operation. The Anglo-Indian force spent the night at Sheikh Said and destroyed all surviving Ottoman gun emplacements before withdrawing to their ships and resuming their journey westward to Egypt on 11 November. While the operation at Sheikh Said was a military success, it raised political difficulties that would bedevil the British in Aden for the remainder of the war. Military officials in India had drawn up the plans without consulting the authorities in Aden, who had been engaged in delicate negotiations to isolate the Ottomans in Yemen. Much of the diplomacy had targeted Imam Yahya, leader of the Shiite Zaydi community in the northern highlands around Sana'a, the capital of Yemen today. The Imam had struck a truce with the Ottomans in 1911 and agreed to rule the province of Yemen in alliance with Istanbul in 1913. Though Imam Yahya was in no position to break with the Ottomans, he was keen to establish cordial relations with the British. The bombardment of Sheikh Said changed everything. The Imam Yahya was incensed, and the Ottoman Governor-General of Sana'a broadcasted a manifesto depicting the ulterior motives of Great Britain, who was bent on annexation, Harold Jacob, a British official in Aden, wrote. "Our action had aided the Turkish propagandists." The Imam, for his part, claimed the affair of Sheikh Said had aroused Arab suspicion everywhere. Rather than securing Britain's position in South Yemen, the attack on Sheikh Said had actually left Aden more vulnerable. It was easy enough to drive 500 soldiers from an isolated coastal fortification. It would prove much harder to defend the 9,000 square miles of the Aden Protectorate from the 14,000 Ottoman soldiers stationed in Yemen, reinforced by Imam Yahya's retainers. The Ottoman guns at Sheikh Said did not, in fact, threaten British shipping. The Bab el-Mendeb is 20 miles wide at its narrowest, so British ships never needed to pass within range of Turkish guns. Turkish mines and German submarines posed a far greater danger to shipping, and to combat those threats took sea power, not land forces. The Royal Navy dispatched warships to impose a blockade on Turkish ports along the length of the Red Sea coast, and to keep the sea lanes open to friendly shipping. Their success could be measured in the scores of cargo ships and troop transports conveying goods and soldiers from the Empire through the Red Sea to the Suez Canal and the war zones beyond. Starting in September 1914, Egypt was flooded with thousands of soldiers from Britain and the Dominions. The East Lancashire Territorial Division, sent to relieve the professional army in Egypt for service on the Western Front, was the first to arrive in late September. The Indian Expeditionary Force from Bombay reached Egypt towards the end of October, its soldiers posted to cities in the Suez Canal zone. The first wave of 30,000 Anzacs completed their journey from New Zealand and Australia to Alexandria in early December. Thousands of reinforcements followed in the ensuing weeks and months. The railway lines between Alexandria and Cairo were clogged with troop trains moving armies of men and horses to camps around Cairo. The Australian infantry settled to the west of Cairo in Mina, near the pyramids, the Australian Light Horse in the leafy southern suburb of Ma'adi, and the New Zealanders in Zaytun Camp, to the north of Cairo, near Heliopolis. The influx of imperial troops helped to stabilize a tense situation in Egypt. Since the outbreak of the war, Egypt had been shaken to its political foundations by a series of momentous events. The Ottoman declaration of war and the Caliph's call for jihad, the severance of Egypt's centuries-old ties to the Ottoman Empire, the deposal of Khedive Abbas II, and the accession of Sultan Hussein Kamil under British protection. The people of Egypt had grown weary of the British occupation after nearly 32 years, and looked on Germany as a possible deliverer. German victories over British forces on the Western Front, such as the Battle of Mons in Belgium, 23 to 24 August 1914, only encouraged such hopes. The British authorities feared subversion by German and Turkish spies, rebellion by Egyptian nationalists, and religious rioting by the excitable masses. The sudden arrival of thousands of foreign soldiers convinced the local population that the British position in Egypt was too strong to challenge. The Anzac training camps surrounded the city of Cairo with tens of thousands of cavalry and infantrymen, stirring the desert dust with training and manoeuvres. To impress the townspeople of Cairo, who might not have seen the soldiers at drill in their suburban camps, the British authorities ordered the newly arrived troops to parade through the heart of the city. "We had a great march through the winding streets of Cairo some days ago," Gordon Harper, a cavalryman from Canterbury, New Zealand, wrote in a letter home. "We penetrated all the old Cairo native quarters through miles of alleys and slums and variegated stinks." Harper grasped the political significance of the parade. "The idea was to impress the natives who simply swarm here with our strength, as they still have a traditional and spiritual connection with the Turks. The effect was very interesting. The route was packed with fezed men and veiled women who watched us closely without the semblance of a smile or a cheer, but every indication is that they are petrified with British rule." British and Imperial soldiers became tourists when on leave from their camps. Soldiers posed for photographs on horse and camel before the Sphinx, pestered by hucksters with artful forgeries of pharaonic antiques. They were lured into shops in the bazaars with signs that played on Anzac humour. "Don't go elsewhere to be cheated, Australians. Come here." And "English and French spoken, Australian understood." The Egyptian tourist trade, ever quick to adapt to a changing clientele, renamed hotels and restaurants after every township in Australia and New Zealand. Among the new venues were the Balclutha Bar and the Waipokarau Reading Rooms. The European quarters surrounding the Ezbekiya Gardens catered to the leisure activities of the foreign soldiers in Cairo. Officers gathered in the restaurants and terraces of the grand hotels surrounding the park, like the famous Shepherd's, the New Hotel, and the Bristol. The common soldiers frequented the cafes and bars in the narrow side streets to the north of the park, known as the Red Blind Quarter, or the Wazza, from the Arabic street name Wasa, Cairo's red light district. The packed bars and brothels of the Red Blind Quarter, filled with soldiers seeking relief from the tedium of camp life and desert drill, proved a volatile environment. Tired of waiting to be sent to war, sick of the vile, doctored liquor sold to them in cheap bars, and bearing grudges against the prostitutes that had given many soldiers venereal diseases, for which there was no real cure at the time, the Imperial forces became a threat to law and order the longer they stayed in Cairo. Anzac troops rioted in central Cairo on at least two occasions in 1915. On the eve of their departure for Gallipoli in April, and again in July of that year, drunken soldiers attacked the brothels of the Red Blind Quarter. Different reasons were given for the outbreaks of violence, soldiers accusing whores of robbery, or seeking revenge for having contracted venereal diseases, or even claiming a racist attack on a Maori soldier. On each occasion, soldiers destroyed the personal effects of prostitutes, throwing linens and furniture from the windows into the streets below. Wardrobes and chests, too big to fit through the windows, were carried to the tops of the five-story buildings and thrown from the roofs. The crowds that gathered to watch the spectacle piled the furniture and set it alight. Fire quickly spread to the buildings overlooking the narrow alleyway. In April 1915, when the British authorities dispatched mounted military police to restore order, they confronted a drunk and angry mob of soldiers who refused to obey orders. All sorts of things were being thrown at the police, one eyewitness reported. Kettles, bits of furniture. The police fired warning shots over the rioters' heads before shooting into the crowd. Four or five dropped, but the others simply went on facing the police, who were about 5 yards away, as if nothing had happened. Fire trucks were dispatched to bring the flames under control. When they turned their jets of water on the rebellious soldiers, the rioters attacked the fire hoses, disabling the truck. At this point, British soldiers were called to the scene and took up firing positions, back row standing, second row kneeling, front row lying down. The officer in command warned the crowd in the street that he must fire if it didn't disperse, and it dispersed at once, an eyewitness recounted. 3 rows of men like that are not the sort of thing you care to face when you are unarmed. The riot broke up around 8 p.m., with 5 Anzac soldiers wounded and 50 under arrest. British reports gave no figures for Egyptian casualties in the April Troubles, though several houses were burned to the ground. Yet more houses were burned down in the July 1915 riots. For the residents of Cairo, these dangerous disorders contributed to growing hostility towards the Dominion troops and the British occupation that had brought them to Egypt. In his account of the riots in the Red Blind Quarter, veteran Egyptian politician Ahmed Shafik expressed dismay that soldiers would stand by and watch their comrades set fire to brothels without intervening, and that the Anzac soldiers showed so little concern for the lives of the women inside. Had these events happened in any other circumstances than the war, they would have ignited a major revolt, Shafik concluded. Those soldiers, particularly from the Dominions, treated the Egyptians with crudeness and contempt. The influx of imperial troops, rather than stabilizing things, was making a tense situation in Egypt worse. Yet the people of Egypt would continue to play host to British and imperial forces for years to come. Their country was an important staging post, training ground, and medical base for soldiers who would fight in Egypt, Gallipoli, and Palestine, in campaigns that would last to the very end of the war. Egypt's northern ports, Alexandria and Port Said, also served as important maritime bases for British and French shipping, as they asserted their mastery over the eastern Mediterranean. After the Ottomans entered the war in November 1914, Britain and France imposed a blockade on the Aegean coastline, from the Thracian port of Dede Arch, the modern town of Alexandroupoli in northeastern Greece, to the island of Samos, south of the Turkish port of Smyrna, modern Izmir. The combined Allied fleet, known as the Eastern Mediterranean Squadron, reached a full strength of 18 battleships, 40 destroyers, 15 torpedo boats, 12 submarines, and 20 monitors, shallow-draft warships with heavy cannons that were notoriously unseaworthy. The squadron was based in Mudros Harbour on the disputed island of Lemnos, just 50 miles from the Dardanelles. At the start of the European conflict, Ottoman sea defences along the straits were outdated and inadequate. Shortly after the Germans and Young Turks concluded their secret alliance on 2 August, German ships began to ferry men and materiel to the Dardanelles to reinforce the straits. The Allied bombardment of the Dardanelles on 3 November 1914, which destroyed much of the Sedul Baha fort at the entrance to the straits, set back their work. The Ottomans and Germans redoubled their efforts. Hundreds of German soldiers and military engineers designed and built new batteries along the European and Asian shores, installing powerful guns to deter ships from entering the strategic waterway. The aged warship Messudie, built in 1876 but armed with heavy cannons, was anchored inside the Dardanelles with its guns pointing out to sea. Turkish ships laid hundreds of mines in neat rows running southward from the Narrows at Çanakkale and around the Black Sea entrance to the Bosporus. Powerful searchlights were placed on the headlands to expose shipping at night, and a Marconi radio telegraph system was installed to provide modern communications between military posts. The Ottomans concentrated their Mediterranean fleet in the Dardanelles to protect their capital city, Istanbul, from Allied attack. The two German warships transferred to the Ottoman fleet in August 1914, the Breslau and Goeben, were deployed to the Bosporus to protect Istanbul from the north and to attack Russian ports and shipping in the Black Sea. By the time Turkey entered the war in November, the Bosporus and Dardanelles were much better defended from naval attack. However, the Germans and Ottomans recognized that the straits were not impregnable. The German admiral overseeing the works reported in December 1914 that he believed a strong Allied fleet could still break through the Dardanelles defences with the loss of 4 or 5 ships. The Ottomans' infantry served as their ultimate deterrent against an Allied attack on Istanbul. Both the Germans and the Ottomans believed the Allies needed to land troops in order to occupy Istanbul. They could not do so by naval power alone. In order to secure the capital and its hinterlands, the Ottomans concentrated the largest part of their army in the Straits and in Thrace. Between the Ottoman First Army, 160,000 men, which counted some of the most experienced Turkish troops among its ranks, and the Second Army, 80,000 men, the Turks could boast a force of nearly 250,000 soldiers, half of the armed forces mobilized by November 1914, to defend the capital from an Entente landing. With the Turkish navy confined to the straits, Ottoman coastal towns on the Aegean and the Black Sea were highly vulnerable to Allied attack. In both the seas, Entente warships disrupted economic activity and lines of communications. Russian warships bombarded the Black Sea port of Trabzon on 17 November 1914, spreading panic and inflicting a great deal of loss in life and property, according to the American consul who witnessed the attack. Between November 1914 and March 1915, the Russians attacked Trabzon 6 times, sinking ships, damaging the city, and driving the townspeople to seek refuge in the surrounding countryside. The Russians also shelled the Turkish coal mines in Zonguldak to disrupt a vital energy source for Turkish and German ships. In the Aegean, the British and French opened fire on the port of Izmir, where a number of merchant vessels had been trapped by the blockade. In retaliation, the Ottomans seized 3 British ships as prizes of war and sank them at the mouth of the harbour to obstruct entry by Allied war vessels. This left 6 other steamships from the United States, Greece, Bulgaria, the Netherlands, and Germany bottled up for the duration of the war. In the coastal region of Cilicia, where Turkish Anatolia borders the Syrian lands, the Ottomans feared for the security of their railway lines. With the closure of all maritime lines of communications, the railways played a particularly important role in the transport of troops, materiel, and supplies from the provinces to the front, in the Caucasus, Mesopotamia, and Syria. The port of Mersin, linked to the Baghdad Railway through neighbouring Adana, had no sea defences at the start of the war. Some 16,000 troops, as well as large shipments of ammunition, were reported to have passed through the Mersin-Adana railway line at the end of November 1914. Unable to mount any deterrent to Allied vessels, the Ottomans were forced to submit to the humiliation of French warships entering Mersin with impunity, impounding and destroying ships at will. The Gulf of Alexandretta, due east of Mersin, was another crossroads of rail and maritime communications. The Baghdad Railway reached the Mediterranean coast at this point, though in 1914 the line remained isolated from Adana by unfinished tunnels in the Taurus Mountains, and from Aleppo by ongoing works in the Amanus Mountains. This meant that passengers and cargo had to disembark the trains and be transported around the mountain obstructions to resume their rail journey from the other side of the unfinished tunnels. These inconveniences notwithstanding, Alexandretta served as a transit point for tens of thousands of Turkish troops running between Syria, Mesopotamia, and Anatolia. In December 1914, the British light cruiser HMS Doris entered the Gulf of Alexandretta to bombard the railway line from the sea. On Sunday morning, 20 December, the warship opened fire near the village of Dertil. Shot after shot was fired at the railroad line, H.E. Bishop, the American consular agent in Alexandretta, reported, the ship slowly proceeding along the coast towards Alexandretta. Shortly after midday, the ship entered Alexandretta harbour under a white flag and sent a tender ashore to deliver an ultimatum to the town's officials, explaining that the railway lines served to transport Ottoman troops to fronts where they threatened British forces, particularly in Mesopotamia. The British commander demanded that the Ottoman authorities surrender all rail stock and war material for a British landing party to destroy on shore. Should the authorities fail to comply, the Doris would bombard all administrative, rail, and port facilities with her heavy guns. Any civilian casualties would be the responsibility of the Ottoman authorities, the British having discharged their obligation under the Hague Convention of 1907 by giving fair warning before firing on the unfortified port. Jamal Pasha, one of the ruling CUP triumvirs, had just assumed his new wartime commission as commander-in-chief in Syria. When he received word of the British ultimatum from the district governor of Alexandretta, he responded impulsively with a counter-threat. He refused out of hand to surrender rolling stock or war material to the captain of the Doris. As a nation at war, he agreed the British were within their rights to fire on government buildings. However, for each Ottoman government building damaged by the British Navy, he threatened to retaliate by ordering the immediate destruction of a like number of English properties and institutions in Syria. Yet more inflammatorily, Jamal informed the British commander that he had interned scores of British subjects in Syria since the outbreak of the war. He now threatened to shoot an English subject for every Ottoman citizen killed in any hostile action taken by the Doris against the city of Alexandretta. Jamal's provocative response escalated the Alexandretta incident into a full-scale crisis that was defused by American diplomacy. The United States was still a neutral power in the Great War, it would remain so until April 1917, and enjoyed cordial relations with the Ottoman Empire. The Americans also agreed to represent the interests of the Entente powers within Ottoman domains. Both the British and the Ottomans seemed open to American mediation to get them out of the deadlock of ultimatum and threats of retaliation. Working with the Turkish and German officials in Alexandretta, U.S. consular agent Bishop secured a 24-hour grace period to negotiate a resolution. Since Jamal Pasha was unwilling to evacuate the civilians of Alexandretta, the local governor hoped to avoid bombardment at all costs. The British commander, for his part, was very concerned about avoiding the retaliatory killing of British subjects. Bishop reported to the captain of the Doris that there were no troops in Alexandretta and that, according to local officials, all munitions of war had been already removed to the interior. In a confidential aside, Bishop noted that he later discovered there were other munitions of war here at the time. Bishop suggested that the Ottomans could be brought to accept the destruction of two locomotives, ostensibly the only materiel of war at Alexandretta, which would fulfill the Doris's mission of disrupting military communications. After consultation held between an officer from the ship, the governor of the city, and the writer, Bishop later reported, It was decided that the engines would be run into an open space and would be blown up in the presence of a representative of the ship and myself. The Doris provided the high explosives for the job, and a party of four officials, an Ottoman captain, the harbour master, a warrant officer from the Doris, and the American consul, set off at 9:30 p.m. to witness the destruction of the two forlorn locomotives.